it's a patience game. And that's something that a lot of early stage startup founders really have a hard time with when it comes to PR. It's building relationships, but it's also figuring out what are the stories we're going to tell that's going to be interesting. And I can't tell you the number of times I've heard from a reporter, okay, that company sounds interesting, but let me know when they have news to share. And then I'd be happy to meet with the CEO. And understanding what news is, I think, is hard for a lot of people who haven't been in the news game.
Hey, it's Adam Schoenfeld. Welcome back to the Built in Seattle podcast, where Seattle's top entrepreneurs, investors, and leaders share their stories and their lessons from behind the scenes. If you like this show, you might also like my personal newsletter. Each week, I share a lesson, a question, or an idea that I've picked up while learning from others. Subscribe at adaminseattle.com. On this episode, I met with Katie Kernute. She's the founding partner at Kingston Marketing Group, or KMG. Before that, she was SVP at Zillow, where she ran corporate communications and public affairs and had a great 11-year career building their data-driven PR and brand strategy that was very well known. We talked about her story going from small-town Illinois into journalism and then landing in tech, the principles of good PR, and how to demystify brand building in startups. I hope you enjoy the conversation. I'm here with the one, the only, Katie Kernute. Hey, Katie. Thanks for coming
Adam.
On the podcast.
Nice to be here.
I had to twist your arm just a little bit because you said that you're typically more behind the scenes and not often doing this. So thank you for making an exception.
A little bit. Once in a while, I'll get on a stage in the old days or on a podcast or something, but usually it's me helping my clients shine instead of me helping myself shine. But I'm still happy to be here.
Yeah. What led you to that, to being that kind of person where you like to be behind the scenes helping other people shine in that way?
Part of it's probably just personality. I'm a serious introvert. I was a shy kid. I got into journalism because I liked telling stories. I didn't necessarily want to be talking about myself all the time, but it's something I've had to learn to do over the years. You don't become an executive at a big brand tech company without getting comfortable talking in front of people and having your voice heard. So I've definitely gotten a lot more comfortable with it over the years, but it's still not my favorite thing to do. I'd still rather be helping you out if you had a big speaking opportunity, figure out how do I shine and what's my story to tell and things like that.
Very cool. You mentioned that you started your career as a journalist. What drew you into journalism right out of school? This was, I'm not going to try to make you feel old, but this was a few years back.
It was a few years back. Yeah, it definitely was. I grew up mostly, I spent my high school years in a small town in central Illinois, and it was not the most worldly place, but I was always looking for more and looking outside and trying to figure out what was going to be next for me. And I really wanted to travel. It wasn't something that I wasn't surrounded by people who were well-traveled at all, but it was something that really appealed to me. And I was a good writer and I liked writing. So I thought, the combination of those things, how can I capitalize on something that I know I like, that I'm good at, that will get me to expose me to a bigger and broader world? So I went into journalism for that reason. I studied it in college. I went to University of Illinois in Urbana and studied journalism there. It was a fantastic journalism school, Pulitzer Prize winning professors and things like that. And I worked at the student newspaper. Some of my best friends to this day were my co-editors at the student paper there. And after school, I moved to Boston pretty quick. I spent 6 months in Spain teaching English, which is a little bit of a gap year type of situation. And then I moved to Boston, where I started working at sort of small community newspapers. Initially, went to a bigger daily, covered a lot of cops and courts. I was the only person on staff who spoke Spanish in an area where there are a lot of immigrants from Uruguay and Paraguay. So I went out on a lot of different interesting assignments there. And then I got into business writing.
So. Got it. What at that point were you thinking, hey, I'll be a career journalist? Or what was your kind of thought process at that point?
What was funny about journalism at that time is there are a couple things. It's no secret. Journalists don't make very much money. I was living in Boston. It was an expensive city. It was a struggle, no doubt. It was a paycheck to paycheck struggle. I got into business journalism, which was better and it was interesting, but I found that my day-to-day routine was always similar. It was always, you get up, you're interviewing somebody, you're writing your story, doing the same couple of tasks over and over. The content's always interesting and different, and you learn a lot. And that part was great. But I didn't like the repetitiveness. And so I started looking for something else. The company that owned the newspaper I worked at the time, they actually made most of their money by collecting and reselling real estate data. So you can start to see where this story goes. They had been around for 100 years and they had never used their data to do PR. So I went to them one day and said, what about me doing that for you? So I ended up getting a job starting their PR department there. And it was a fantastic success. I'm not going to sell myself short. I was good at looking at the data and telling stories, but it was also just a really tricky time in the housing market. It was, I think I started that job in 2006. We know what happened a couple of years later. We had the massive recession and housing crash. So people were really curious about real estate data. So I was able to mine the data that we had as a company, that they were going out in New England and collecting data from every single city and town and get some great coverage for them. So I did that for about a year and a half. And then Zillow called. And that changed my life forever. I went from this little family-run company in Boston to this venture-funded startup surrounded by these huge players in the tech field. When I started talking to them about the job, I didn't quite know what I was going to get myself into. I had no concept of what to even expect. What was this going to be like? What are these people like? What's the opportunity like? I just had zero clue. But my husband and I, we had just gotten married. He had gotten his third bachelor's degree from Berklee College of Music, and he wanted to leave Boston and look for other opportunities. And Seattle sounded interesting. So we went for
it. What did that call look like? How did they come to you? Or what was the sort of, what went on that first call with Zillow?
I think what had happened was they knew they had launched Zillow. So this was in 2008 that this happened. They had launched Zillow in late 2006 to great fanfare. The Zestimate was such a fantastic product. It was intriguing. They got a lot of attention for it. And they were trying to figure out what is our ongoing marketing plan and strategy look. And they very smartly realized, we have Zestimates. We have this data. We can tell stories with it. So we need someone to help us do that. And at the time, it was really probably a handful of people who did that kind of thing. There just weren't that many of us across the country. But in those days, I think PR was, there was certainly a thought leadership component to it, but data storytelling wasn't a big part of it yet, at least for profit companies. It was a bit for nonprofits and academia. So I had a call, I remember, with the recruiter. And she wanted to fly me out right away. So I flew out to Seattle on my own. My husband couldn't come. I think he was having finals or something like that. And I had never been to Seattle before. So I met with Amy Batinsky, who was, I think Amy's title then was director of communications or director of PR, something like that. Met with her. She would go on to become my manager and mentor for the next decade plus, and a few other people at Zillow. I think I didn't meet Rich Barton and Lloyd Frank at the time. But I remember that they wanted Spencer Raskoff to interview me, but he wasn't there. He was on the road when I was in Seattle. So I spent 24 hours in Seattle, took a walk to the Space Needle from Hotel 1000, got to know the city a little bit, and went back to Boston. A couple of days later, I had a call with Spencer. He was walking down the street in New York City on a business trip, which is the most Spencer interview ever. If you ever meet him, he's like the fastest moving guy you've ever met. And they offered me the job pretty quickly after that. So we closed up shop in Boston. I gave my notice and we drove out to Seattle.
What was the state of Zillow at that time? How big was the company when you had that conversation, when you decided to join?
It was under 150 people at that point.
Okay.
So we were in the Wells Fargo building. We were on two floors at that time, but this was also August 2008. So a couple months later in October, that's when the recession hit. And it was a really uncertain time. Zillow did a layoff at that point. All the VCs had been saying, cut early, cut deep. We don't know what's going to happen. So Zillow did layoffs. It was really difficult. I made it through the cut. But I'll always think back to that and admire the way that the leadership handled it. It was really a very kind way that they handled this, but it was a tough time for everyone.
What was it that they did that made you have that reaction? What sort of shined in that hard moment about how specifically leadership handled it?
They were really thoughtful. I remember Rich Barton got up in front of, they divided people up into groups so they could tell the people who were being laid off separately. And then the people who were not affected stayed, and Rich, they were really emotional about it. They were really authentically emotional. They cared a lot about the staff and how people felt and their livelihood. So I think just that kind of authenticity. And also one of the things I'll always take from that is how important it is for the leader of a company themselves to deliver a tough message. It's advice I always give to my clients now. It's if you have a really great message or a really tough message, it needs to come from the top. Or if there's something that you really want your employees to understand that you mean, it needs to come from the CEO. We talk to a lot of companies about messaging around pay equity or DEI and things like that. And it can't come from just the head of HR. They can certainly be the main spokesperson, but the CEO's got to say something if you want employees to understand that the company really cares.
What a great learning to see at that point. I'm curious if you had any inkling that you would work in tech or venture-backed startups or anything of that when you were back in Boston doing journalism?
Zero.
And did you have any context on like this world?
None. In Boston at that point, Boston's a pretty big startup hub now, but it wasn't then. It wasn't at all. And I was coming from this pretty insular background of journalism. I was covering, I covered business journalism, but I was covering real estate and banking. I wasn't covering tech or startups or any of that. And we knew about Zillow, of course, because I was in real estate. And so when Zillow started, everybody was talking about them, but I didn't understand what it meant at all and what it was like to be on the inside of a company like that.
What gave you conviction then to bet your life on it, moving across the country and pivoting your career and all these things?
It just, at that time, it didn't seem like a big risk. I was pretty young. I didn't really think about what would happen if it failed. I guess I just didn't get the gut feeling it would, meeting all the people and hearing about how it had been growing so far. I was excited about the work too, which was the big thing, right? It was such a cool job to get in that seat and to be able to look at what was happening in the world. The most important business story of our time was the housing recession, and we were in the middle of it, and Zillow had a real conviction that it wanted to be unbiased in how it told the story and provided the data. And you have to remember at this time, there were very few other sources of data about the housing market. It was still pretty opaque to people. So you had industry kind of associations saying things like now's a great time to buy a home leading up to the recession. And then you had the other widely used index is one called the Case-Shiller index, which is used to value mortgage-backed securities. It's a great index, but it's not really helpful in telling you what's happening on Main Street necessarily. So working with Stan Humphries, who is a chief economist at Zillow, and just getting to craft this program that would go on to really inform people about what was happening and give them insight that they wouldn't have had otherwise was really fulfilling, and it was fun to be able to do that kind of work.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about this, the impact of this strategy? You were really early in this whole data-driven PR thing, right? And now we see more companies doing things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, how was it constructed at the onset? I guess maybe it is a good place to start.
Yeah. Zillow was interesting because we didn't spend money on marketing for years. So the whole strategy was earned media, word of mouth, SEO. So coming in there, there was, I won't say there was a lot of pressure because there wasn't really, there was patience because everybody knew building the muscle and the relationships would take time, and they were willing to give us that. But it was a pioneering thing, and I don't know if I really realized it at the time, how different what we were doing was. I did start to realize it a couple of years in when everyone else started doing the same thing, you know, and I was getting calls all the time from other companies saying, non-competitive spaces saying, hey, could you advise you know, us on this, and how do you do this, and how do you think about it? And it was a fantastic strategy. And to this day, I think it's a great strategy for a lot of companies, not every company. It really depends on the data they have and the stories they're able to tell. But I think it can be a great way to, you know, build relationships with journalists, to provide information that is has something to do with your company, but isn't designed just to inform people about a product or a service, which is powerful for PR.
Yeah. Let's break that down a little bit. I want to unpack the principles that make that possible, or the situations where that would work. So if you have a company, let's say you're doing some SaaS product, or you're doing some, you know, direct to consumer product, or whatever it might be, marketplace. When companies come to you, how do you figure out if they're a good fit for that kind of PR strategy?
Yeah, well, so a couple of things. The thing I'll always tell clients, which may seem counterintuitive, everybody loves the Zillow story. They love the idea. Oh, so you guys got on the map with PR. Everybody sees PR as a cheaper option. And I say, yeah, that was 2008. I would never advise anyone to do that today. The media landscape has changed. It's much more noisy. There are a lot of other people doing this now. Thought leadership and data PR is a staple of a lot of different companies' strategy book. So I tell them first, like, you have to look at this holistically. Let's start with your goals. What are you trying to do? Is it brand awareness, right? Is it, or are you under pressure to get users or sign accounts very quickly? If that is the case, you need to be looking broadly at all sorts of marketing strategies. And that's part of why I started KMG with my business partner, Nancy. She's a marketer. And we really think that integrated marketing, which is looking at the entire spectrum of channels and brand and possible ways to communicate with the outside world, is really important. So I always like to start with goals, and I like to direct people away from just thinking about PR, especially if you're in a smaller startup that doesn't already have a marketing engine going. You really need to look at this holistically and be really goal-oriented, not go to a tactic that sounds interesting and cheap, but think about what's going to move the needle for you. The other thing we do is we have to look at the data, because not every company has data that you can mine for interesting stories. There's ways around that sometimes. We do a lot of surveys and that kind of thing, and those can be great. But to really get to a program that's going to put you in a space where you're a notable thought leader in an industry or an area, proprietary, nothing better than proprietary data.
Yeah. How does the flywheel actually work with the proprietary data generating the PR? Because you mentioned, you know, you can do surveys or studies or sort of one-time-ish things. But what, like, how important at Zillow was the ongoing nature of it and the way that it reinforced the trust in the product? I mean, can you talk a little bit about the virtuous loop that was in play there?
Yeah, absolutely. At Zillow, the goals for what we were doing were, of course, awareness. We were a very young company at the time. People were getting to know us, but they'd gone on and checked their Zestimate. And we didn't even have listings, real estate listings, when I started. So it was really just getting going. So thinking about why this worked and how it can work for other companies, there are a couple components that I like to talk about when it comes to data PR. And any kind of data PR program will, a good one will encompass some or all of these. And one of the things that I think is really important is what I'll call a pillar report. And this is a regular report that you do. Maybe you've created an index. That's what we did at Zillow. We have the Zillow Home Value Index that tells you something about a marketplace. And you are putting that out at regular intervals. This does a few things. This helps journalists understand when it's coming, look forward to it if it's valuable, and gives you an occasion to talk to them frequently. This allows you to do things like have deep conversations with reporters and say, what are you working on? Is there something I can do to help? Here's all this other data I have that's not in our report. Would that be helpful to you? And we did that a ton at Zillow. We had our regular reports. We talked to reporters, we built relationships with them, and we would end up doing exclusive research for them. We did that for the Wall Street Journal, for the New York Times, for all sorts of different media outlets. And the results of that was fantastic. Front page, above the fold stories, when that kind of thing mattered, before everything was digital, but really wide, viral for the day stories. And it, because PR, like a lot of other things is relationship driven. You have to have an occasion to build those relationships. And it's hard to do that cold. Mm-hmm. It's hard to reach out and say, hey, I have an interesting company. Want to meet? One of my friends who's a reporter told me that she's getting 200 or 300 pitches a day.
Wow.
She's at CNBC and it's just crazy. There's so much happening in the media today. And that goes back to why I think looking at goals holistically and incorporating other parts of marketing and content into a strategy is always the way to go. The cool thing I'll say about data PR too, though, is we call it data PR, and I need to think of a different name or get out of the habit, but it's really data storytelling. And if you're telling great stories from data, you can use those in lots of different ways. It's not just for earned media. It's just not just to pitch to journalists. You can write op-eds with it, but you can also use it for your content strategy, paid or owned. And that's really powerful to be able to have more interesting content to put out into the world.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to come up with a name for data PR and then market that name. You can have a category and a framework, and that could be your book title. So we're waiting. Exactly. Listeners are waiting. I wanted to ask you about this story when you pitched the White House on a public event.
Yeah.
And what's the story there?
Yes. So that was in 2011, I believe. And one of the things we did at Zillow, really when I first started, is we started doing government relations. We weren't lobbying at the time. We didn't really have a need. We weren't heavily regulated or anything. But we engaged with a government relations firm and just started building relationships. And we didn't know, we figured we would need them someday and we might as well start now. But we also saw this as a potential additive strategy to our PR strategy. So we built relationships all over Washington. It was great. We provided a lot of congressional offices with housing data. Our chief economist was a witness at a congressional hearing once on housing. We were able to really kind of use these relationships to build our thought leadership and our credibility. And we had built a relationship with the White House at that time. We had provided them with data and tried to be helpful where we could. And I think a few months before that happened, LinkedIn had done an online event with Barack Obama. And we said, why not us too? They talked about employment. What's the other pillar of his economic plan right now is housing. So we're like, that should be us. We're the experts here. So we sent a proposal and it languished for several months. I would check on it. I had something on my calendar to check on it every few days and, hey, any movement on this yet or anything? And we had gone in thinking, should we do a live town hall? And we'd have conversation. They say, okay, we maybe want to do it, but we want to do it in this way. It kept going back and forth. And then one Thursday, we got a call from them and they said, okay, we want to do it on Monday. President Obama is going to be in LA. And I think he was doing Jay Leno the night before. And we want to do a sit down with your CEO, who's Spencer Raskoff then, and have a live town hall. And you guys are going to use your channels to get people to come to this, right? As well as our channels. So we said, okay. So we put together a crack team. It was me. It was our head of social media at the time. And it was our head of events who had just been hired. And we worked all weekend. Our head of events, she put together in this hotel ballroom, she created a studio. She got all the vendors to come. We had to rent a satellite truck. I was working with the White House on content all weekend, right? Called tons of phone calls, sending questions back and forth. We also had to activate our social media network to get questions from people. What do you want to know about the housing market? And figure out, like, how do we figure out what the top questions are and all those things. So we did it. I think on Sunday, we flew to LA, went to the hotel we were staying at, the same hotel as the president. So the Secret Service was all over the place. And we're up until 3 a.m., woke up at 5 a.m. to do the checks with the satellite truck and all that kind of stuff. We all holed up in the room and practice. I have a lot of pictures of me sitting in the chair that Barack Obama was about to sit in, just grilling Spencer on questions and making sure he was ready to have that conversation. And then we get up, he's coming. And we all kind of step back and President Obama walks in the room and he was so nice and knew everybody's name, knew a lot about Zillow. And they sat down and they did the town hall and it was fantastic. It was a real turning point, I think, in Zillow's brand because of the massive amount of credibility it gave us. And it was a ton of fun. It was such a cool experience.
Right. It sounds like a lightning strike to have that happen. But what it also sounds like there was years of buildup to make that Absolutely. Possible with the data and all of these mm-hmm. things.
Absolutely. None of this stuff happens overnight. And it's that building these relationships takes time, just like it does in real life and personal life. And it also takes just persistence. So that tactic, put it on your calendar, check on it every Tuesday. Sometimes it feels annoying, but it works.
I love that. So you've been in this space a long time and you've seen this evolution. You mentioned that you wouldn't do the same things again, given what's changed in the media landscape. Like, how do you talk about that change that's happened and what does good look like today? If we can't just copy the playbook that you put in place at Zillow 10 years ago, what are the really thoughtful, like, PR and communications people doing, particularly in startups today?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I think it's looking at the big picture and not thinking of PR and communications as separate from marketing, but a part of your marketing. And understanding that once in a while, you'll get a great big story, something really interesting will happen, you'll launch a fascinating product. That's rare, by the way, but it happens once in a while. Or your company is maybe, I think of one of my clients, Syndia, that's a pay equity software company. They're just on the forefront of something that everybody's talking about. So for them, there are a lot of opportunities. If you're in a space that's deeper B2B or something like that, it's a patience game. And that's something that a lot of early stage startup founders really have a hard time with when it comes to PR. It's building relationships, but it's also figuring out what are the stories we're going to tell that's going to be interesting. And I can't tell you the number of times I've heard from a reporter, okay, that company sounds interesting, but let me know when they have news to share. And then I'd be happy to meet with the CEO. And understanding what news is, I think, is hard for a lot of people who haven't been in the news game.
How do you explain that? What is news? Because it's hard, right, when you're a founder and you think that your company is amazing. And I get what you're saying. If you're SpaceX, you can just do PR on your product. And if you're Syndio, you can just do PR on pay equity because that's such a hot, the world is changing around that and it's a top of mind. But what if you're everybody else? How do you think about actually creating news?
Yeah, I think one of the things I like to do is really create a powerful content engine. A lot of founders have fascinating ideas and takes on things. So using that and using what's in their heads already, not to pitch a journalist necessarily, but to get content out there on the right channels for them is a really good strategy. And lots of times that leads to PR relationships, to journalist relationships, and to ideas for the news stories. One of the things I like to get CEOs to do is to write once a month. Maybe it's not them writing, maybe it's a ghostwriter or me or somebody, but just build that muscle. Like start, what are you thinking about? What does your platform look like? And how does it relate back to your company? But in those early stages, how can you be out there as the face of your company? Because that's important. It has to be a person and not a company talking. And tell stories that are going to be helpful or interesting to this audience that you want to reach. And there's almost always a way to do that. But again, it's a patience game. It's rarely a month one, unless you got something real big going on, you're probably not going to get in the New York Times. But that doesn't mean in 6 months or a year you won't, and that it can't become a regular thing if you put the work in and do it right.
Yeah. What do you say to the founders and the early leaders that are like, I'm not a marketing person, or I'm not an external person, like I'm a product person, or I'm about the tech? How much do you push them out of their comfort zone, or just in general, how do you approach that conversation of trying to get their unique and interesting point of view out in the world?
Yeah, there are lots of different ways to do it. And I really like it when CEOs are authentic about how they do this. I get a lot of people who ask me about Spencer Raskoff, who is, you know, CEO of Zillow for 10 years. He's still a client of mine. We talk all the time. And he just took to Twitter like a fish to water. He did himself. When it first came out, he loved it. He loved engaging like that online. It was one of his favorite things to do. And we were able to use that as a building block to building his profile and thus Zillow's profile over time. And that's not everybody's cup of tea, right? Not everybody. I don't really tweet. I'm not a big social media or Twitter person myself. And that's okay. But there is a channel for you, whoever you are. And maybe it's writing. Maybe it's doing video interviews on LinkedIn or something else, but there's a way to communicate your ideas, and it's okay to have other people help you too. It's a ghostwriter is fine for a busy CEO. And lots of times the tech and product leaders, especially if they're in a B2B space, it's like what's in their head is really interesting to their audience. So there's nothing wrong with getting that out there. I also like to look at the bench in a company, right? So the CEO is important, obviously, but there may be a really dynamic COO who's super passionate about a mission and great on camera. So why not use that person? There's a reason Sheryl Sandberg's out there more than Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook. She's fantastic. So I like to do those things, but committing to communicating is important.
Once people are signed up for the agreement that it's a patience game and that it takes, you have to find kind of the right channels that fit you, that fit your style. Like you mentioned, Spencer was great on Twitter, but maybe others it's video, others it's podcasting. Maybe Clubhouse is a thing now with audio. How do you go about that exercise of trying to help a founder or a leader pick the channel that's going to authentically fit their style?
I look at what they're already doing. It's if they're not on Twitter already, like I'm not going to try to get them on Twitter. I may set up a profile for them and we may tweet a little bit, but that's not going to be their main means of communication. So I'm going to look for what feels natural to them and what feels best to them and have a lot of conversations about it. And then there's always a bit of trial and error too, right? You may say, okay, let's write a piece once a month and we're going to post it on LinkedIn and we're going to pitch it to Fast Company. That may be our goal to build that muscle. And it's like pulling teeth. They don't want to do it. They hate it. Then you may have to switch tactics at that point. But there are lots of ways to make it easy too. And I've had people who send me voice memos to write something for them, things like that. It doesn't have to be super difficult. The hardest part is having the ideas. But the good thing is startup founders have a lot of ideas. I've never encountered one that doesn't have good ideas.
So just pulling them out and packaging them, getting them in the right places. I love that. Okay. I wanted to get some quick takes on just questions that when I'm talking to early stage founders, I hear these questions a lot. So in your book, what is brand?
Brand is the contract you make with your customer. It is not a logo and a color palette, or it is not just a logo and a color palette. It is a contract you make with your customer. And it's so important. We do a lot of brand work at KMG. My business partner, Nancy, and one of our head of our marketing practice, Todd Olson, they're fantastic at this. And we see a lot of companies that come to us seed stage or a little bit after that, who just haven't done the work to build their brand. And they start, the way that their brand is expressing itself is not consistent. So people don't understand what that contract is. You want the customer to understand it just as much as the company. So we do a lot of work with companies, like helping them figure that out. What are your brand purpose, your mission, your core values, all of those things are part of it, but there's a whole framework that you want to have to go back to at any moment in time. And I look at the importance of this. I look at something like, say, Airbnb at the beginning of the pandemic, and you couldn't imagine a company in a worse place to be at the beginning of the pandemic. But they had also done a lot of new stuff at that point. They had a magazine going, they had experiences, they had all these different things. They pivoted so quickly back to their core. And I think it's because they have such a strong brand. They understand what they're trying to deliver. And their customers understand that too. So they were able to get back to the core and make it through in a big way with an IPO. So brand is super important at any stage of your business. It's always worth doing some of that work.
So that contract, you talk about it as a contract that you make as a company with your customer. Mm-hmm. So you can see that coming through in like this Airbnb situation, right? Like they came back to, they were clear on it. Everybody understood it from both sides.
Exactly. Okay.
I like that way of thinking about it. What is marketing?
Marketing is the many different ways that you're communicating with your customer. And with not just with your customer, but with other stakeholders too. It's broad, right? It's a lot of different things. Brand is part of it. So it's how you're communicating, but it's also what you're communicating, the substance of that communication.
Okay. And then what is PR?
PR is part of marketing. And PR and communications also are not necessarily the same thing. PR, I think of as, although I think the definition is expanding, I think it's really earned media, right? So media that you don't have to pay for is like, how are you getting yourself in that? But I think PR, I like to think about not really PR anymore, but communications, I think, is better, because I think that encompasses a lot of channels that we didn't used to think of as part of a PR department. So owned channels, like how are you communicating on LinkedIn? And there might be a paid component to some of those too. How are you communicating on Twitter? And do you need to put some paid behind it so enough people see it? It's all kind of melding and coming together. So I think that to look at those things in silos is a big mistake. You have to look at it at the whole of your marketing department, which includes communications and PR.
And that might be the answer to the question I was going to ask next, which is where do people go wrong looking at it in silos? Or maybe a way to follow up on that is, yeah, you mentioned that people can sometimes get lost looking at these in silos. How does that show up? Like, how do you know that they're lost in that world or not seeing the bigger picture?
Yeah, I think you can tell when, I think there's a mindset that like PR is the cheap marketing option. And I think that's a big mistake. Like, you really want to look at the goals. And this is when the mistake people make is when they move too quickly to tactics. I'd much rather have my first conversation with a prospective client be, tell me what you're trying to accomplish. Are you trying to drive users to a specific action? Are you trying to build brand awareness? Is it all of it? And then we can come in and figure out what are the different components you need. And there are plenty of places that for whom we just do comms or PR, and they have a marketing engine that we plug into and work together with. But for a small startup that doesn't yet have that engine, it's really important to just think through that. And it doesn't have to be expensive. We're not talking about having a big marketing budget for paid or advertising or anything like that. It's really get in and do the strategy. And then let's figure out how we can fit that into the budget that you do have. And what's going to move the needle? That's the thing I always want to do. I never want to work for a client for whom I can't move the needle on their business. I don't want to do busy work. I don't think that winning is press hits in a vacuum. It's how does that impact the other things that are important?
Well, Katie, this has been so much fun talking about this. And I would love to wrap it up with the Supersonic Six.
Sure.
Number one, how much coffee do you drink?
I'm a disappointing Seattleite. I drink one decaf cappuccino every day.
Number two, what's one other Seattle company that you're following or studying right now?
I really like to watch two of my former Zillow colleagues' companies, Joe Coffee and Own Trail. So I like Joe because we've worked with them in the past and they're just fantastic. Like, I love their mission. I love their story. Like, growing up in the shadow of Starbucks and trying to help independent coffee houses, like, I get chills over it. I think it's fantastic. And Nick and Brendan are just such great people. I'm so happy for the success they've had and for what they're working on. I think it's really cool. And these were both people you had on recently too. And then Rebecca Bastian at Own Trail. I'm enjoying watching Own Trail, and you and I, Adam, chatted about this in the past too, but I think they may be emblematic of a bigger trend of social media moving to more narrowly specialized platforms versus the big platform where you get everything. That I think that is getting exhausting. So it's like, maybe we start going to different places to find what we really care about. And Own Trail is such a good place. We talked a bit about my path, and yeah, my trail is pretty curvy. And I like that. And I like helping women see that it's not always this path that's going to lead to this end goal, that it's really the journey.
So listeners, go back to episode 40 and 41 to hear about Joe Coffee and Own Trail. And related to this, number three, who's one Seattle person that you're following or learning from right now?
Yeah, for sure. Maria Colercuccio, the CEO of Syndio. So I mentioned Syndio is one of our clients. We've been working with them for more than a year. But Maria is just such a fantastic leader. I feel so lucky to have a ringside seat and watch how she does things. I learn a lot from her, how she manages and grows her team and how she really keeps her eye on what's important while growing the company just at an incredibly fast rate. Like, she doesn't have an easy job. No startup CEO does, but she handles it with such grace. I take a lot of the things that I see her doing and apply it to my company.
Love it. Number four, what's one thing that Seattle needs to improve as a startup hub?
I actually took this question to my team because I was wondering what they thought. And what I heard from a lot of them is they really want to see more diversity of companies. There's so many like B2B and SaaS companies here. It'd be cool to see more D2C companies popping up.
Number five, what's one piece of advice you'd give your 20-year-old self?
Pay more attention in econ class. I never imagined that 6 years after I blew off Econ 101 and 102, I'd be writing like white papers about the housing market and the economy. But I managed, but I should have paid more attention.
All right, last one, number six. What can this community do to help you? Are there any calls to action that you have? Anything you want people to go check out or pay attention to?
Well, I think one thing, we're growing pretty fast. KMG is 9 people now, hoping to hire another one soon. So pay attention to our job listings. We have a really fun place to work. It's a great team. We're going to look for office space in Seattle actually next week, although we'll only be in the office 1 or 2 days a week. And we get to work with some of the coolest companies and most interesting projects and VCs and finance and consumer and all the different things. So it's a cool place to work.
Love it. Okay. Check out the careers page at KMG. And Katie, this has been a lot of fun. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks, Adam.
Hey, it's Adam again. Quick note before you go. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you're enjoying the show as much as I am enjoying making it. If you do like it, please leave a rating or a review. That would help other people find it in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you have any feedback, send me an email, adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com. No underscores, no periods, just adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com.